My name is Dewey Spees from G. Dewey Spees from San Mateo, and I'm an alcoholic, and the G in my name is anonymous. I use both of my names as suggested by Bill Wilson in his pamphlet, The AA Traditions, to impress the audience that I no longer fear the stigma of alcoholism. I was thinking tonight of my home group as I'm sitting here and back in Cleveland. I had a little agreement with those boys back there that when we let an AA talk, gave an AA talk of any kind, wherever we were, we received that talk with a brief prayer and with a little bit of silence. I don't want to make a prayer meeting out of this meeting. We know we've had one already. If you'll bear with me, I'd like to repeat a short line. God of our fathers, be with us yet, lest we forget. Lest we forget. There are many things I would like to forget about my drinking career, bought them out greatly, but one thing I must always remember, that when I came into AA, I was licked. There's none of the big shot about me. I was really licked. Tonight, if I am anything above a human deficit, anything above a spiritual, physical, mental, and moral bankrupt, I owe it to God, and I owe it to AA, and to my non-alcoholic wife, who's made it very easy for me to follow this program. There's nothing in my life ever happened as important as AA. In making my talk, I'm sorry to disappoint you. You're not going to hear a great, bit of masterful oratory at all. It's just going to be across the board talk. That's the only way I know how to talk. I like to follow a pattern of telling what I was like and what happened and let the people judge what I'm like now. When I think of the many times I've told my story, I am reminded of a little incident that happened when I was in Cleveland. There were only a handful of AAs at that time, and west of Cleveland, about 30 miles, there was a town by the name of Lorain. They had an AA group. There was two other places, a town about 5 miles apart, had groups. The membership intermingled. And every time they were short of a speaker, for one reason or another, they called me up. I think they had my name right by the telephone. They called me up and asked me to come out. And I've been out there many, many times. One time, one afternoon, I got a call. Speaker failed to show up. Would I come out? And I went out. And that evening, before the meeting started, I drew myself aside to get my thoughts together, and I overheard a conversation. One fellow asked his friend, he said, "Do you know who's speaking tonight?" "Yeah," he said, "that fellow named Spees from Cleveland. Have you ever heard him?" He said, "Hell yes, I can prompt him." Another chap walked up to me one night who had heard me many, many times and said, "You know, Dewey," he said, "your talk reminds me of a verse in the Bible. I think it was the 13th chapter of Hebrews and the 8th verse." I'm not sure, it wasn't very well up in the Bible at that time. I had to wait till I got home, and this is what I read. "Jesus Christ, the same today, tomorrow, and forever." Well, that's why I'm always glad to get out in strange crowds they haven't heard me before. The only one fellow I'm a little leery of tonight, and that's Ken Brown down here. He's heard me before. I'll have to stick reasonably close to the truth, I guess. I was here. Well, I was born in Ohio, raised there, educated there, one of six kids. As far as I can see, looking back at it now, I wasn't any different from any other ordinary kid in the neighborhood. No better, no worse. If I was any worse, I got by with it because I got out of it. I could escape a little easier. I was born in a very, average American home. One of the great class of common people that Abraham Lincoln said God must have loved because he made so many of them. And there was no particular reason that I can see for my being ever turning out to be a drunk or an alcoholic. Because when I was about my people gave me the advantage of a good religious background. I had a good education. When I was about 13 or 14 years old, my favorite uncle died of acute alcoholism. He would have been a natural for AA because he wanted to quit. I liked him, and we got along swell together. He was an expert rifle man, small arms shot. He used to come to the house on Saturday afternoon, take me out in the country, and taught me to shoot. I could tell about what shape he was in. If he gave me a nickel, he probably had a couple of beers. If he gave me a dime, probably maybe I might have a shot mixed up. But if he gave me half a dollar, I knew he was pretty good shape that day. And I always liked him when he was in good shape. Now, there was a man who would have been a natural for AA. He wanted to quit. There was no AA available at the time. He tried everything that was available, didn't go, and died an alcoholic. And when I think of that, I think how grateful we should be, and believe me, none of us are grateful enough for AA, because it was only a matter of a very few years back, 1935, or previous to that, that an alcoholic didn't have much to look forward to. I was down in Bill's office last fall, a year ago, I should say, and got some figures down there. And one man from Hopkins, John Hopkins Hospital, came out with these figures that prior to the advent of AA, the combined efforts of the religious, of the clergy, psychiatrists, and the medicine, were able to help something less than 4% of the people who came to them for help. The figures that Bill gave me were that 51%, approximately, 51% of people who come into AA voluntarily wearing this program, sincerely wanting it, never have any trouble at first contact. Then, there's about 21 or 22% may have trouble 3 or 4 times, and they finally level off in sobriety. So there you have it, somewhere about something less than 75% do gain total sobriety as against something less than 4%. And believe me, you can't kick that around. when he died, it left an indelible impression. I didn't think I would ever touch this stuff. In fact, I went through high school, so I knew what it tasted like. When I got through high school, my parents wanted me to be a minister. My parents and relatives, because there was no minister in the family, and I was it. So my father was bigger than I was, and he was still physically fit. So I consented to go to the seminary. And I say consent in the broadest sense of the word. I went there, and the reason I wasn't sold on wholeheartedly, because I'd had too much of it even then. Every Sunday morning, it was church, Sunday school, another meeting in the evening, once or twice during the week. My dad was very active. He wouldn't say he was a holy ruler, but he was very active in religion. He believed in God and believed in religion, and very active in the work. I used to run the errands for the minister. I used to mow the lawn for him, run, get his mail for him. By the time I was through high school, I already had more than my share, I thought. When I went to seminary for a year, now believe me, I say this to you in all sincerity, if I was cut out to be a minister, somebody sure they all moved when they sewed the parts together. Because I was anything but a minister. I was a rebel at heart. I couldn't make myself get up and believe to tell the things I didn't believe in my soul. I thought to myself that if I'm going to go to hell, I'm not going to go to hell for being a hypocrite. I'll just cut it out. And at the end of the year, I gave the ministry the best break they ever had in their life. I quit. They probably don't appreciate it, but I gave them a wonderful break there. I went down to State University and majored in metallurgy. When I got out of school, I was able to gain employment in one of the leading steel companies in the country. I got a job as a research chemist and metallurgist. I looked around the laboratories for several years, and even then I didn't bother drinking too much. I didn't bother drinking even when I was in college, because, you see, these speed kids came about 2 years apart, and all like that, and sometimes there were two or three at the school at the same time. The money wasn't too plentiful, and I couldn't afford to drink. Even if I could afford it, I think this memory of my uncle, my religious background, would probably kept me on the safe side. I went into the steel plant. I worked 3 or 4 years in the laboratories. I liked every bit of the steel business. I wasn't drinking. Once in a while, I'd go out with a fellow and get a little high and forget about it. And then I thought, if I were going to be anybody in the field days, I would have to get out in the plant and get some practical experience. So I asked for transfer. And they transferred me into the open hearth as a second helper. Now, I don't know whether you folks down here are acquainted with steel business or not. Despite what the Saturday Evening Post tells you in their article, there's no glamour in the steel business. You work with a wheel bar, a sledgehammer, a tool bar, and a shovel. And it works hard and damnably hot and uncomfortable at times. I got down in there, started working with the men, and there was a little bit of reserve there, a wall between me and these fellows, because they couldn't understand why a white-collar fellow would come down and take a job, laboring job. In order to break down that wall, I started drinking with them. I ran into some very proficient teachers, I should say. And I might say in my own behalf that I was a rather apt student. And it wasn't long before I was made The wall of reserve was down. We were all one. Now, there used to be a saying around that steel plant that if you wanted to make good steel, you had to learn to drink good whiskey. And if you wanted to sell steel, you had to learn to hold that whiskey. Well, that was for me. The next 10 years, I'd say my life was pretty much a bowl of cherries. I was promoted beyond my years, and the fellows didn't seem to resent me for going over their heads, and I think the reason was because I was pretty quick on the trigger when it comes to buying drinks. I would buy with anybody, drink with anybody, anytime, anywhere. And all during this 10 years' time, I had noticed here and there fellows doing the pot and drinking. In fact, the treasurer of a nationally known company, you'd know the name I've mentioned, wound up as a suicide in his garage as a direct result of alcoholism. One of our own superintendents, a man with about a 40,000-year man, dropped by the board. The last time I saw him, I was driving from New York to Philadelphia, and I saw him on the highway under the auspices of the state highway department with a cop for a boss. That was the result of alcoholism. But it could happen to me because I had three things I stuck to religiously. I never drank on the job. I never took a drink in the morning. And I never lost any time drinking. Now, morning after Christmas, so what happened, Christmas that year was on Monday. So we had our office party Saturday afternoon. Being a typical alcoholic, I started Saturday morning. And to be honest about it, I think I started Friday night. You know, I didn't want to have the fellows be ahead of me. I wanted to be right up on par with them. Well, we drank that afternoon at the office party that night. Next day was Christmas Day, the day before Christmas. And then Christmas Eve, of course, you have to trim the tree, and we trimmed the tree, they tell me. And next day was Christmas Day, all day Christmas Day. And next morning, I wakened up, went out in the bathroom, started to shave. And I looked in the glass, and I wasn't too sure just what I was shaving. It didn't look like a human. It looked like a red blotch with a couple of black streaks for eyes, and I wasn't too very well satisfied with the picture I saw. And I wasn't very well satisfied with the way I felt, because for the first time in my life, I woken up with the jitters. There were 1,000 butterflies in my stomach, all trying to get out at one time. And I felt so bad that I thought I'd better go back and have a little more sleep. But I was afraid to, because I thought if I would get more sleep, I probably wouldn't get to work. And I didn't want to lose that one part that I never lost any time drinking. I went out to work that morning. I went into the office, turned on the lights, it was dark. And ruffled up my desk, so then the oil in there, and I went to the plant, and I walked around. I walked all around the plant trying to walk these butterflies off. They wouldn't be walked off. They stayed right with me. And then I met an old railroader. Now, there's always been a little bone of contention between the railroaders and the steel men as to who were the heavier drinkers, and I don't think the argument's ever been settled. But then he raised this chap, said to me, "You look like hell this morning." I said, "That's the way I feel." He said, "Have you had a drink?" Well, up to that particular time, a drink in the morning was unheard of, out of the question. I could spit myself halfway across the room just thinking about a drink. And he said, "Well, you've got to have a little hair of the old dog that bit you." Now, I'm not going to tell you that old doggy got me by the shoulders and got me down the floor and poured this drink down my throat, but I will say he used more persuasion than anybody ever had. The result was we went into a little shanty, and we had some of that prohibition hooch, you know, that block and tackle stuff. You walk and block and tackle anybody, and we had a couple shots of that in about a half an hour. I thought I had made the most remarkable discovery of my life. I wonder where I'd been all my life. Here's the answer. You don't have to suffer me that morning. This is it. Boy, I felt fine. So fine, I went down to the canteen and got some breakfast. So that was one of them gone. Then, if the morning after that, if the morning happened to be a little tough, I had ways to take care of it. We had three plants, and I was a freelance. I could go where, come and go as I pleased. And about 10 o'clock in the morning, I would start off at one of the plants, and I'd drop in and have a little shop then. And then later on, not too much later on, I'd stop in the afternoon when going to the other plant and get a shop there. And finally, it got so that I didn't have to steer my car. That car knew just exactly where to go. I didn't have to steer in these places. It was automatic. Two of them were gone. And then, in that came that Black Thursday in October 1929. There had been a bunch of us playing the market on a skinny margin. We could jump on about 20-25% margin call. Money was cheap. We had a dark room in our metallurgical laboratory with a telephone in it. No one was admitted in there without first announcing themselves, not even the manager, lest he might spoil the photograph. And that was our stock exchange. And we were making more money in there, and we were making off the job. And this Black Thursday came along, and I got a call to bring some money uptown, and I did. And Then when the market dropped down and the wise men said it was time to buy, I took everything I had and I bought. We'll level out and I'll be the wise guy. And then came the final break. So not long after that, when the market dropped again, I was wiped out. Well, I guess I must have thought that depression was made especially for me because I went out and went on a bender. All three of my fine things were gone. I stayed in this bender for about 3 or 4 days. When I got back, they weren't too rough with me because they took drinking more or less for granted. I can recall my going when I first started working in the mill, but it wasn't an uncommon sight. If a man was a good steel man, he'd walk in there with a pint sticking out of his hip pocket, or he had a list dinner pail with a top filled with coffee, with liquor instead of coffee. So they tossed me and put me back in the job. About 3 months' time, I began to worry, get the fuming up and feeling sorry for myself about this money that I'd lost. A funny thing about it, you know, as time went on, I lost everything I had. Now, it wasn't a great lot of money, but once all you have, you consider it with that money. But how that amount grew as time went on, believe me, in 3 or 4 years, I just lost a hell of a lot of money over that depression. And I worried in proportion more about it. Well, my vendors would go along about 3 months, and then they'd get a little closer together. And finally, about the end of about a year and a half, an old man called me in and told me that due to the depression, falling off of business, they were going to have to eliminate my job entirely. I know, at my department, I no longer had a job, which was a very nice, gentle way of firing me without using those brutal words. Well, I can't explain just what all my emotions amounted to. In the first place, I was jolted right down to my heels. Then I was sore, and then I felt sorry for them. How the devil were they going to run this place without me? Because I was really a big shot around there by this time. I admitted it. But you know, somehow they managed. Now, I looked at the financial report here not long ago, and looked pretty fair. This was the Republic Steel Corporation I'm talking about. They seemed to manage all right without me, despite the fact that I've been there, they're still going pretty good. So, I would fool those fellows. I would get a better job than they ever thought of having. And I maintain that the devil takes care of the dumb and the drunk, and I get help from both angles. Because it wasn't long ago I had a job as a liquidating manager of a bank. Now, their idea of liquidation, my idea of liquidation, was some little bit of conflict between them. I was down in the wrong side of town. We had taken over a Ford shop, a foundry, a lumber yard, and a scrap yard, all on the wrong side of the railroad track, and too close to the place where they put out Jago Red. And in about 11 months, they called me up in the front office, and they decided they could do the liquidating up there, and I was fired again. And I was worried about that. We were getting worried then, because my drinking seemed to be unusual. And on top of all this, my mother died, which is the most severe blow I had yet suffered. And because she was always my anchor, it seemed to me that I had never gone to her once in my life that came away that she didn't give me something, some kind of moral support, something to live on. I wasn't exactly a mother's boy, and she didn't dominate my life, but she certainly was my good friend, my mother. When she died, I thought the world had gone backwards. And I knew I had to do something, but what? And I finally arrived at a very brilliant conclusion. But I wasn't fault of my drinking. It was these lousy guys I was running around with. Those are the fellows who were getting me drunk. I was all right. It was the rest of the world that was crazy. So I decided that if I would go away somewhere where the sky was blue and the grass was green, start my life over again, I could be a gentleman. And that was it. I started out, and for the next 10 years, I roamed across this country, up and down, crisscross and diagonally, running here and there. And the fallacy of that particular way out is this. If you are an alcoholic, old John Barrick, and he's always sitting right up here. I don't care whether you're in Denver and Detroit, or whether you're in Birmingham, or in Baltimore, or in New York, or in San Francisco, where you are. Old John's up there. Now, at that particular time, I was periodic. My pattern was something like this. I would go into a strange town, and I would be absolutely on the level, and go along for about maybe 2 or 3 months. Well, you know, you can't be around a town for much longer than that. You can't sit around reading the Ladies' Home Journal and the YMCA every night of your life. You just can't do it. And you have to have a little company. So you go down to the bar. And I've never been to a bar in the United States before I could meet somebody who knew my Uncle Henry or knew my Aunt Mary or somebody that I used to work with. And if I couldn't find any of those, a bartender was always a good bet. And the first thing I knew, I'd build up a circle of friends who were just the same as the ones I left. And about the time that wherever I was working, about the time I was beginning to show some promise, and they began to rumor around that the new fellow knew his stuff, that's about the time I had to go out and get drunk. I always got drunk at the wrong time, the wrong place. I recall one time, I used to work for Ben Perlis, the former chairman of the Board of the United States Steel Corporation. when he was our general manager. Now, I knew Ben, and he knew me, but after all, I was a metallurgist, and he was a general manager. I don't mean to say that we were hobnobbing around together. But one Christmas morning, about 4:30, I found out later, we're at this party, and I realized it was Christmas morning, Christmas Day, and I ought to call Ben Farrell's up and wish him a Merry Christmas. So I did. I got him on the phone at 4:30 in the morning. And I said, "Mr. Farrell, this is Dewey Speeds. I want to wish you a very Merry Christmas." And Ben was silent for quite a little while. Finally, he said, "Dewey, by God, I believe you mean that. This is the third time since noon yesterday you called to tell me that." Well, this 10-year geographical tour of mine to cure my drinking habits came to a rather abrupt end down in the Valley Forge Hotel down east. I had been working for a steel company there for a few months, and I had some money. I had some good clothing. Christmas morning came along. I was feeling terribly sorry for myself because I was alone. In the meantime, I neglected to tell you that my own personal family had broken up and my children were separated from me. I didn't once consider that morning it was my fault. I just felt sorry for myself. So I went into the hotel. I went down to the bar. I told Al to send up 3 quarts of my favorite whiskey. And he told me he couldn't send me 3 quarts. They couldn't afford to sell that much to one customer that day because they were running short. I put on the best sales talk I had. I told him we were having a very special party the other day, and I wanted that whiskey. I spent a lot of money in that bar, and I thought I was entitled to it. Well, he finally sent it up. The only thing I didn't tell Al was that I was the only one invited to that party. Now, I'm not too sure just what went on that day, excepting that about 6 o'clock in the evening, a fellow who knew I was in this room, and why he should be interested in knowing about me, I don't know. He came right to the door, and I had the hiccups, and they had developed to a point where it affected my heart, and I couldn't talk. And he knew I was in there. He went down and got the clerk, and came up with a key, and they took one look at me, and they called for a doctor, and the doctor came. I was too far gone to move, and he shot something into me, and then several hours later, they took me to the hospital. About 2 days later, when the fog lifted, the doctor came in. He was a little short, squatty fellow with a perverse sense of humor, I always thought. He sat down on the edge of the bed, and he told me, in so many words, that my drinking career had come to crossroads. One of those crossroads was sobriety, and the other one was the bottle in my grave. He said, "You're not very well acquainted around this little town here, are you?" I said, "No, I'm not." He said, "Well, we have a hell of a nice little graveyard out here in town." He said, "There's old revolutionary heroes buried out there, famous men." He says, "There's ivy growing up over the tombstone." He's that nice kind of ivy. "And there's nice pine trees out there. It's a peaceful place. And if you want to drink, you're working for a good company. I think they'll plant you there at no cost yourself. That's up to you." I walked out. Well, gentle officer, nobody ever talked to me like that before. I could feel the dirt on my heels. And, I was really scared for at least 10 minutes. And then I thought, well, that old buddy, he's just trying to scare me, the same as the rest of the doctors and psychiatrists. I had to figure out something like this. I didn't think I was bad enough to go to hell, and I knew damn well I wasn't good enough to go to heaven, so I just had to stick around for a while longer. I called a nurse then. I wasn't too sure about this thing. She looked at me and she said, "Well, I don't have any reason to lie to you. I don't believe you realize how close you came to dying in here in my arms the other night." So I, as much as I like to drink, I like to live better. And you can do a lot of things when you see the old side in your face. So I quit drinking. Absolutely quit drinking. I decided I was going to make it permanent this time. No fooling. So I finally got myself a job. Where do you think I got that job? The Republic Steel Corporation gave me a job. In the export office down in New York. One of the very finest jobs that was available to give a man. Well, I worked like the very devil. I paid my debts, and I began to assume some degree of respectability, and the job was going fine. I made one mistake. I thought I had to drink with all of my customers, and I'd be into getting too many customers. And there were rumors around that place, rumors rolled around that pertained to me, that something about a separation. Now, that brings us up to 1939. In 1939, there were a group of men in Akron, Ohio. A group of alcoholics were banded together to help to try to solve this problem of drinking. And there were 12 men from Cleveland in that group who were toying with the idea of separating from the group and going to Cleveland to start their own group. There were certain tenets of the Oxford movement, religion. I believe the Oxford group has been described as a non-sectarian, evangelical, religious group. And there were certain tenets about that religion that were unacceptable to the men of the Catholic faith and those men, and two men, some of the men of the Protestant faith. And they had the idea that AA should be made acceptable to all men of all faiths. They talked to Dr. Bob about this. Dr. Bob was not opposed to the idea. He didn't think the time was right for a total separation. Nevertheless, in the spring of 1939, these 12 men broke away, went to Cleveland, started their own group. Well, this separation was made complete somewhere in the latter part of May 1939. Well, this separation that was being rumored in New York, which affected me a lot more personally, and one day it came to a head. The old man called me and he told me this. He said, you know, you have a brilliant drinking career ahead of you, and I think it's a shame that anything as prosaic a job should interfere with that. And he told me he was arranging a separation for me and my company so that I might give 100% of my time drinking instead of 95% of my time. Well, I couldn't understand how they were going to get along, and I didn't know what to do. So I did what an alcoholic does when he doesn't know what to do. I went out and got drunk for 3 weeks. And when I got sober, I decided I would have to get a job. I still like to eat once in a while. I was going set to go back into another steel plant, and I met a man in the street one day whom I scarcely knew, and suggested I go to an industrial chemical plant near Philadelphia, who wanted men with steel plant experience to go into that business. I went down there, and I didn't like the looks of the place. I didn't like the guy that interviewed me. And he called the president and the vice president that treasured the company in, and I wanted to know how much money I wanted to go to Cleveland. I thought, well, I'll set these boys back on their heels. I asked them for twice as much of the job as you'd pay, and much to my surprise, they met it. And I hedged again. I said, well, I'm going to have to eat expense money, and money for a car, well, we'll meet that. So, talk about getting help from the dumb and the drunk get help from the devil. I guess I was there. Because 3 weeks later, I'm in Cleveland as a divisional sales manager of this chemical company in a town I didn't want to be, on a job I knew nothing about. Now, since that has happened, I've looked at it many times. At that time, I may have thought it was coincidental. But after all, a man who has been trained in one line and knew nothing but the steel business doesn't ordinarily drop that and go into something entirely foreign, and especially when he doesn't like it. And I think this, I had little to do about getting to AA. I think it was the answer to somebody's prayers that I got in there. I think that was the time when God began to weave a new pattern in the fabric of my life. And that's how I come to go to Cleveland. Because I got there when AA got there, just as they got there. I was able to secure a place to live in the home of a very wealthy lady who thought I was a very much of a gentleman because I told her I didn't drink. Of course, I did admit to telling her some of the past. And I started working again. Everything was going fine. I was making money, and things were opening up, looking good. But I began to get depressed feeling. I got to the point where I couldn't go into my room at night and go to bed. I thought the walls would close in on me. And I got to thinking about my children, and it made it worse. And I would have to walk around or go out and get tight before I'd go to sleep. I got so bad that I was afraid I would have to go to the doctor. And I really was afraid to go to the doctor because I was sure. You see, I did my drinking during Prohibition days, and I was sure after all that homebrew and all that hoops I swirled down my gullet through the years, certainly there would be one of my kidneys would be gone, or my liver would be shot, or maybe I'd have heart trouble, or stomach trouble, or an ulcer, or what have you. But I finally had to go. The doctor gave me a complete examination. And when he finished, much to my surprise, he said there was nothing organically wrong with me, excepting that I had a little low blood pressure. He said, did you drink speeds? Oh, no, the idea. No, certainly not. So, I can't kick on his prescription. He said, I'll tell you what you do. You get a quart of good brandy, and I think if you'll take a shot every night before you have your dinner, I think it'll help you. Well, you know, I never cared with too much interest in the medical profession before. I never cared too much about doctors. But there was a doctor I really liked, you know. There was a fellow with a dog I eat. And, of course, I did burn the rubber off my heels getting down to the liquor store and getting that bottle. And every night before my dinner, when I come in, I would take a shot, about that much in a water glass. I didn't want to cheat myself. I wanted to be honest with myself. By the time I got to the restaurant, that was kicking around, the world began to look rose-tinted again. I did that for 1 week straight, and I never felt more proud of anything I'd ever done in my life. Now I've got it licked. Now, by God, I've got to control myself. Well, the next week, I got toying around with the idea. Going to bed, getting in bed, get a book, and then take a big snort, and then just gradually ooze away and sleep. And boy, it was wonderful for a couple of nights. Just a wonderful way to go to sleep. And then one day, I met a fellow on the street, damn it. And he said, how about going in, how about a glass of beer? Well, all right, a glass of beer won't hurt. So we went in. How about a little shot? Well, one. Now, mind you, we're not going to get drunk. I've got this thing under control. So we had a shot and a beer, and then we had a beer and a shot, and then we had a shot and a beer. And 3 weeks later, the old lady who thought I was a perfect gentleman was trying to find some way to get me out of that house without calling the cops. Now, another thing that may seem coincidental. Here in the city of Cleveland, city of upwards of 750,000 people, there were 12 AAs in Cleveland, about a week, two. And this lady I was living with was a very religious person. She didn't drink, but she knew somebody. Her sister had an uncle who had a sister who was married to a guy knew one of these fellows. And one of these fellows came to see me. I'll never forget my first contact with AA. It was Sunday afternoon, Sunday. I was home in my room all alone. That is, I thought I was alone. Actually, I wasn't. I was stretched across my bed for the simple reason that I was too drunk to stand up. And in the room with me, there was a miniature suit of the band. These fellows were about that high. They had black beards and red uniforms, and by God, they could play, too. They marched underneath my bed and over the top. And they played the Stars and Stripes forever and ever and ever and ever and ever. And I tell you, I have never heard that piece played like that before, nor since, and I hope to God I never do. Because after about 4 hours, the Stars and Stripes forever begins to taste of the keg, you know. And finally there was a knock at the door. And before I could answer, in stepped the Holy Roller himself. And he looked at me and I looked at him, I think. And he said, I understand you have a drinking problem. And he said, I would like to talk to you about AA. And if you want to talk, I'll give you as much time as you want. And he said, a drinking problem? I put a little square. I didn't have a drinking problem. From my bed where I was, in the closet, I could still see there was a half a case of granddaddy. It wasn't any problem for me to go there and get a drink. What the hell is this guy talking about? And in my wildest drunken imagination, I couldn't figure out what an automobile club had to do with stopping drinking. I told him. How patient he must have been. Well, he started talking and talked and talked, and he kept on talking. And I was hoping he would quit. You know, I wanted to take a drink, but he looked like he might be a minister, and I didn't want to drink in front of him. And he kept on talking. I think he was vaccinated with a Victrola needle or something, because he couldn't stop. He just kept on, and I passed out. And the next morning, I wind up in a hospital, a nursing home. I never heard of AA before in my life. And outside of my room, two guys were talking about this AA. And they told me, I heard them say, it was total sobriety the rest of your life. My God. Well, as soon as they left, I put on my slippers and my robe and went down to the end of the hall of the pay station. I called this fellow up that poured me in the night before. And I said, look, Ed, I know damn well I've been drinking too much and I want to do something. But hell, Bill, let's not go aboard with this thing. What do you do at Christmas time or New Year's Eve or on your birthday or when you go back to the homecoming game? You just had to have a little bit once in a while. He said, no, they just didn't drink. Well, I thought, all right, perhaps you could do it. Well, what's the point of living? You might as well flop down and die. It wouldn't be any sense living if you couldn't have any fun. And that was my attitude toward AA. So when I got out of this nursing home, I went to several of these meetings. And I'll tell you that nobody ever came into an AA meeting more skeptical, more cynical than I did. There wasn't anything new about it. They were talking about prayer and about God. My mother told me to pray when I was that high. I knew about God, too. And I never was an atheist. What I wanted them to do was to tell me to do this and this and this, and 6 weeks give me a diploma and I'd never drink anymore. But they didn't do it. Another thing I resented very much, they treated me just very much like the rest of the ordinary drunk. And I thought I wasn't an ordinary drunk. I had a very inflated opinion of my own intelligence. And so, at the end of 7 or 8 meetings, if they're not going to realize my real worthwhile, I'll get out of there. So, I was a little bit like the story they tell about the I felt this way, that this didn't affect me, you know, because this was for alcoholics, for God's sake, an alcoholic. The idea, that word just burned in my soul. I was a little bit like the two soldiers up for their physical examination prior to the discharge, and the doctor noticed a strawberry, a rash on his cheek, and the likeness of a strawberry, size and shape. And he asked the boy whether he'd gotten that in the service. He says, no, he didn't. He says, his mother marked him that way. He said, about when she was pregnant with him, about 3 months before he was born, she developed an intense desire for strawberries and could think of nothing but strawberries. She ate all she could. She just couldn't get along without them. And when he was born, that strawberry appeared. The next chap came up and said, Doc, isn't the guy silly to think that a mother can mark a baby? Now you take it my case. It's about 3 months before I was born. My mother went downtown to the music store one afternoon and she bought some records and she stepped out and decided what was icy and she fell. And she broke every one of those records. But it didn't affect me, it didn't affect me, it didn't affect me, it didn't affect me, it didn't affect me. Well, you know, that sounds pretty silly, but I was just as silly as that fellow was. Just absolutely as good as that. Because here I have the one thing. I have A in the palm of my hand, the one thing that will do me, the only thing that will do me any good. I tossed it aside because it doesn't affect me. But not for long. It wasn't long until I put out the bender, the end of the old benders. And when I thought I was going to die, then I began to think about it. I recall that morning, I wakened up. You see, I had a cold, kind of a flu cold, and I'd been drinking in bed for 9 days. I was nursing this cold very carefully so it wouldn't get over too soon, you know. At the end of the 9th day, the old stomach rebelled and they began to bounce. And I tried bitters, and I tried lemon rind, and I tried ginger, all this and that, and no soap. I got, they were up and out. That's expensive business with old granddad. So, what to do? I didn't know what to do. I, waking up at 7 o'clock in the morning, I'm afraid I'm gonna die, or at 9:30, I'm afraid I won't die. And, what to do about it? And I looked at that bottle that morning, and the thought came to me that all the real troubles of my life came right out of the neck of that bottle. Right out of the neck of it. I could think of my domestic troubles, my financial troubles, my job troubles. Somehow or other, liquor was at the bottom of it. When I wasn't drinking, I wasn't in trouble. And I had, as I said, I had an inflated opinion of my own intelligence. I thought I was a pretty smart cookie. But that morning the thought came to me that for a man who pretended to be as smart as you are, about time you quit kicking yourself around, that a dog wouldn't go back and bite a poisoned bone time and time again, knowing full well what to do to him. And I made up my mind I wanted to quit. I have always been, since I've been in AA, I've bent over backwards, never to speak as one with authority, because I'm one of the least. But I'll go this far. I think that that's the feeling we must have. That we must, for ourselves, not because the wife was pushing us or any of the boss or anybody else, we ourselves will get to the point where we want to quit, and I want to quit. Well, what to do about it? I tried that, and then I happened to think that there was a fellow I met gotten into AA, and he was doing pretty good. He was a hell of a drunk, worse than I was. And maybe those holy rollers had something. I would go back again, and I went back. And I went back, and I talked to the fellow. I said, Bill, tell me about this AA business. And I started from scratch, and he laughed at me. You remember, Smith? You were down here a few weeks ago, and you were telling us how to run this thing. You see, I thought, you know, if they adopt some kind of middle world policy, don't go too strict. They let the fellows drink a little beer during the week. Not on meeting nights, of course, but a little bit. And then I thought, too, if they would take this book and let somebody get in there with some little promotion ability and rewrite that book. In fact, I had a fellow of mine for the job. I won't mention his name, even use your own imagination, but somehow or other, he didn't seem to go for the idea. And I said, Bill, will you forget about that? I said, I really want to know. And I'll never forget how kind he was to sit there with me after taking all my lip a few weeks before. He told me this was a spiritual program, that if we lived in such a way as to deserve it, we could get spiritual help to control our drinking problem. He said, control, not cure, control. And then almost in the same breath, he told me it was quite important that we go on out when we've been helped and try to help somebody else. He laid out a plan for me that every morning before I go to my office or go out on the road, I should have a few moments of prayer and meditation and ask for help to stay sober that day and then that night to express my gratitude. He said, that's the way we do it, a day at a time. And friends, that's the, I must admit, that is the first thing that I grudgingly admitted sounds sensible in the AA. It didn't sound nearly as bad as doing it for life. And that I could go for it. But when he said prayer, then I felt the hair turn up on the back of my neck, and I thought, I can't do it. Because I had no faith in myself, I had no faith in God, and no faith in my fellow man. You see, all my faith had been shattered. When I was a youngster, going to Sunday school, I read about the Christians. How when they were placed in prison, and somehow or other, through prayer, the locks dropped off, and they walked out free. Now, well, I'm going to tell you folks something right here and now. I never prayed to lock off a jail door in my life. Somebody always had to come down $10 and cross, or I stayed there. I had no faith in prayer. Besides, when I used to go broke, I used to pray for a pocket that was $60, and I don't know why, don't ask me why, instead of $40.70, but I wanted $60, and I never found more than 2 bits in my life. So prayer wasn't for me. And then I was about to tell him that I couldn't go along with the thing. I thought, well, wait a minute, buddy. You're at the last port of call. This is your last chance. You have nowhere to go. I didn't realize it wasn't my last chance. It was the only first real chance I ever had. So I thought, well, I got everything to gain and nothing to lose. Sure as hell, they can't make a worse mess out of my life than I made out of myself, and I'll go along with them. I'll do what they tell me to do mechanically for 30 days and see how it works. Now, whatever they wanted me to do, I would do it. That meant walking down the street in my nightgown and a derby hat smoking a cigar, I'd do that too. I dared them to sober me up. I started going to the meetings, but this time was different. I went there to find out what they had. The speaker didn't bore me, and I listened. I was confused. I remember Doc Smith came to me after the meeting. He said, how you doing there? I said, well, I'm confused. I just like a kid going to school. He said, that's fine. He says, this is an institutional learning. He said, in this institution, we are both the teacher and the student. And there's no provision for the teacher to retire, and no provision and no graduation for the student. He says, well, one thing, don't take your algebra before you take your arithmetic. So in those days of confusion, I heard many things I didn't understand, many things I didn't believe. I still hear things I don't believe. But something came to help me. Some words have been in my unconscious, subconscious mind for years. When I was a youngster, I used to pump a pipe organ at every Sunday at the church, and I got a half a dollar for it. And I didn't pay any attention to what the minister said. I was too busy figuring out what to spend, what to get for this half dollar. But one day he said, when you pray, give us this day our daily bread, be sure your tablecloth's clean, and you'll have a better chance of getting your daily bread. And those words came back to me from time to time, even in my gentlest organs. And they came back now. And somehow a light seemed to filter through this thick cranium of mine. Maybe that was the reason I never got any help before. Sure, I prayed. Many times I prayed. I prayed, and before the echo was out of my mouth, I had my hand under the mattress to see if there was a bottle underneath there. Prayed with a heart full of hatred, resentment, indecency, all that sort of thing. And somehow I had enough sense to realize that if I'm going to get any help from God, I've got to start cleaning this tablecloth of mine. That was 20 years ago. I'm still cleaning it. It's not clean. There's still a spot there. The best I can say for it is there are not as many. They're not as black as they were. I have a little better control of things. And maybe it's a good thing that some of those spots are still there, because as long as they're out, I have an incentive to keep going to AA. I think perhaps if I could get them all cleaned up, I might lose interest. But as long as they're there, I'm going to stick around. It's been very nice sticking around. Well, they kept telling me at this meeting where I went. Incidentally, I belong to a stuffed shirt group, the so-called stuffed shirt group. The men of this meeting were a little higher income bracket than the rest, and they wanted to pick their members from a certain area. So I got up one day and I told them, I think the third meeting, I said, now you fellows have been telling me to work this program, and all I've heard is what a good job you've gotten since you've been in here, and how much money you made, and how things are going. I want to know how you work the program. And I didn't know at the time that the whippersnappers weren't supposed to talk till after about 3 or 4 months. So they decided, I guess, that they would put me in my place. So last week I got a call. This fellow had written into New York. He'd been drinking since he was 13 years old, and he wanted to quit. And the call came back, and they gave it to me. I started down Sunday morning to see this fellow. It was in the winter times, zero weather. And I walked into the room, the most abject poverty I've ever seen in my life. There was a man sitting on the edge of a bed, a little kid crying in the corner. He got beat up every time he opened his mouth. And the wife had the grips packed and was ready to leave. That was the picture. Well, I finally got her quieted down, and she agreed to give me one more chance. We got the youngster quieted down. And then I went over and talked to this fellow. At first, I thought he had St. Vitus dance. I never saw a fellow shake as much as he did. And he shook. And I talked to him for 10 minutes. I was scared to death. I don't know what I said to him. And I'm damn sure he doesn't know what I said to him. But when I went to the door, he came back to the door with me. He said, Mister, can you come back tomorrow? Yes, I'll be back tomorrow. I was back the next day, and the next day, and the next day, and the next day. This is my kitten. I'm going to have it. I lived with him. And finally, after about 4 or 5 days, he started to work. And she started back to work. And I recall I was there the first night he got a paycheck, and she showed it to me. It was the first industrial paycheck she'd ever seen in her life. Seems he'd always find time to take care of that little chore of cash on the way home, and she never knew what he made. And he never gave her much of it. She had to work herself. Sometime later, I was there, and a little boy came out and laid down a little pair of shoes and a top coat and a romper suit. And he said to me, Mister, I ain't scared of my dad. He got these for me. And then I thought, for the first time in my life, how many people we hurt other than ourselves? I had a little boy, too. Maybe I hurt him. It hurt me, too. About 3 months later, he called me and said, come down. I moved into a new place. I went down that night, and he had moved into a cottage. It wasn't a palace at all. It was a nice, clean little cottage, and there were vines and grapes at the window, and there were rugs on the floor. He was sitting there at the table with his boy helping him with lessons, and she was sewing listening to the radio. And they thought a modern miracle happened. He had been sober for some 3 months, and there was honest-to-God food out in the refrigerator instead of that half loaf of bread and that half bottle of milk in their apartment that morning. I had never seen happiness shine out of people, shine out of people's eyes like shine out of theirs. And that night I became an AA in fact. That's the last time I'd just been enrolled. Because up to that night, I had some doubts about myself. I had been a no-gooder, and I wondered whether it would pay, whether it was worthwhile for me to stay sober the rest of my life. People would always remember the dirty, rotten things I had done, and I would always be a no-good so-and-so in their eyes. Was it worthwhile? But that night, there seemed to be a patch of blue in the sky. I thought to myself, now, if I could go out and forget myself and try to bring a little happiness in the lives of other people, maybe I could be people, too. Well, it worked out beautifully. I got into AA, within AA, when the Saturday Evening Post articles came out. And when they came out, people began to rush into Cleveland from all parts of the country, wanting to know about the AA program. For a year and a half, we worked every spare hour we had. We'd go home at night and be listed the names in the hotel. Some people came in and wanted a book, and some wanted to talk for half an hour between trains. Sometimes we went home with them and helped them start their groups. And I strongly recommend this to the new people here tonight, that if you want to stay sober, get into this thing and work. It's the best protection against drinking I know of. And I also want to say to you this, don't let my 20 years impress you. Because the new man comes in here tonight, walks through that door tonight, with a sincere desire to stop drinking. He's just as much an AA as any one of them. Because there's no clique, there's no seniority in AA. The only seniority we can claim is not in years, but what we have done for ourselves and what we've done for the fellowship. Well, this worked out beautifully. My time was still taken up for about a year and a half. I didn't have time to think of drinking. And I attribute that to the fact that I got off to a good start. Now, as going along with my AA, there was one thing bothered me. I'm going to bring this to a close, too. I've talked longer now than I should, but I don't seem to be wound up. I promise you I won't talk too much longer. The one thing bothered me. When I came in, I remembered this bill telling me about the spiritual experience, and I had heard people tell about their spiritual experience, and they were nothing short of miraculous. And I listened, open-eyed, goggle-eyed. Somehow it never happened to me. You know, I never felt any angels fluttering their wings on my shoulders at all. It just didn't come around. And I heard Bill Wilson say more than once during the time when he used to come visit our groups quite regularly, tell about his experience in the hospital, that he wasn't much strong for for a prayer of any kind. When he thought he was going to die, he said, "Oh God, if there is a God, ask him to show himself to me." And then he said, of a sudden, he thought the light flared up into a dazzling brilliance in the room, a white light. And he thought he was standing off on a hill and the winds were blowing through and cleansing his body and his soul. And then he was afraid because he thought he was going insane. And when Doc Silkworth came back in, he asked him about it. And if Doc had been a less humane fellow, we wouldn't have AA today. If Doc had told him that he was nuts, that would have been it. But Doc was honest enough to admit to him that in his lifetime as a practicing physician, there have been some few cases where men were apparently recovered from incurable diseases through spiritual experiences. Bill, I don't know what you have, but whatever it is, hang on to it. So I would go home at night. I remember this story. I'd lay down on the Davenport and lie there, and I looked up the old chandelier, you know, and I watched that thing, and nothing ever happened. Once in a while, a bulb would burn out, that's about all. I got a little sore about it. If it could burn up for Bill, why couldn't it do it for me? So, went on, and I had even gotten up and was asked to talk about the spiritual aspect of AA, and did I talk about it, and didn't know what I was talking about. And came Christmas time, another Christmas party. Now, I didn't go to that party, stayed home with my wife. Well, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, she went out to distribute some gifts, and I went up to my office, I had an office in my own home, said, "Sit down and deliberate while I'll take a little inventory." And I began to think, I've been sober now 11 months, and I was the first time in my life since I've been drinking heavily, that I was happy. Now, I don't mean to say I was talking around, giggling down my sleeve, but I was reasonably happy. I had a feeling of well-being, and with it, things were going well. I had an income example for a good, comfortable living. My wife and I were getting along famously, and things were all right. And then I began to tear that apart. The boss couldn't do that for me. He couldn't give me happiness and sobriety. My father and mother couldn't do it. My brothers and sisters couldn't do it. The doctor couldn't do it. The clergy couldn't do it. And I couldn't do it myself. And I came to this conclusion as a matter of deductive reasoning that I must be getting help from somewhere. And then I happened to remember what Bill said, that we would get spiritual help if we lived in such a way as deserve it. I picked up my little hand dictionary and looked up the word spiritual. Just one line definition that pertained to the heavenly. And then I looked up the word heavenly and said, pertaining to good, and I put the book down. And I thought to myself, isn't this it? If I think good, if I do good, if I choose the good from the bad, if I pray to a good God, in other words, if I act goodly or godly, doesn't it follow that I'm a spiritual? Now, I know that definition is too broad for a theologian, but to me, one who likes his AA simple, it seemed to fit that all I need to think of was spiritual as being good. It made it a little easier for me to tell a man who was still befouled in alcohol that spiritual meant being good and choosing the good. So that cleared the situation up. I got one of the finest things I ever got out of AA. The finest thing I got out of AA was the 11th step, which told me to improve my conscious contact with God. Because I remember when they read the 5th chapter that one night, They said that probably no human being could relieve us of this curse of alcoholism, but God could and would have thought. And then I thought to myself, well, if a man has any common sense, he's just plain common sense to get acquainted with God. And I tried to do that. And as I got better acquainted with him, I began to be myself. I laid the foundation for my humility. When I began to evaluate myself, I found I wasn't a big shot and I didn't have to pretend it anymore. And that's what I got out of that 11th step. And I got a new conception of God. And I'm not going to tell you that I try to describe God, I wouldn't insult your intelligence. But my own first impression of God was this. I got it in Sunday school, out of a leaflet. God was sitting on a cloud way off in the distance, and the angels were playing harps all around him. And that's about as close as I ever came to God. Somebody way off in the distance. Tonight, God is no longer a man off in the distance. He's not even the man upstairs. He's a lot closer than that. God, to me, is a great power of good, ever present with us through our entire life. I can be just as close to God as I deserve to be, and you can be. And I know this much. If I'm not as close to God tonight as I was 6 months ago or a year ago, I'm the one that loses. And I've come to a point where I look upon God's word not as a matter of being sanctimonious or pious, but as a matter of good common sense. To believe and follow his path can be just as comfortable as an old kitchen chair, practical as an old shoe. It's nice to work at. I found that it pays over a long period of time to stick pretty close to the power greater than my own. And I like to think of God as a great light that shines over the pathway in my life. But I know that as long as I face that light, the shadows will have to fall back on me. Thank you.